Welcome to part two of Bob Crew, the Master and the Music. Here's a song that you might remember from the early 60s. Right now, I am pleased to present a lady who is going to assure us that she was just playing a role in that record, and it really had nothing to do with her. And is that correct, Ginny Arnell?
That is absolutely correct. How are you?
Pretty good. You were not really born with a peanut for a brain.
No, thank goodness, no, Ron.
I kind of found it to be a cute record, Dumbhead, that is, we're talking about. But it was somewhat controversial, and I think in your own mind, you had some misgivings about it. Is that true when you recorded it?
Yes, I did. When I first heard the song, I said to my manager, Merwin Brochen, oh, I don't know if I like calling myself a dumbhead. I was about 18 years old, and it just didn't sit right with me. And he assured me it was just a fun song, and nobody thought I was a dumbhead, and he convinced me.
It did make the chart.
It did. And you know, when you start to dissect all these things and phrases and words, it kind of takes the fun out of the music. I think we did well to go with it.
Your first record on MGM Records was not Dumbhead, but it was a song called I'm Crying Too. And the producer of I'm Crying Too was Bob Crew. How did you first meet Bob?
Well, I first met him through the offices of MGM, and they told me that they wanted him to produce my record, and I was very excited because I knew he was working with the Four Seasons, and he had a wonderful background, and oddly enough, I met him in his apartment. They needed a place to practice, and he had a beautiful piano in his apartment. So my manager, my dad, and I went up to his apartment, and he played the music with me and went over it. And I can remember two things very clearly. Number one, he was such a handsome fellow. He had beautiful red hair, and he was a natural redhead, and he had freckles. He looked like he stepped out of California. And the other thing was, he had Siamese cats. He had about seven of them jumping all over the piano. And, you know, I was so busy watching the cats, I thought, for goodness, I can't even think about singing. The cats were scaring me. So he put them somewhere else for a while, and we went on and rehearsed. But it was a very unusual way to meet him, and one that I'll never forget.
We're going to listen to a little bit of that record right now. This is Ginny Arnell, and I'm Crying Too.
The rain is falling from the sky. That's what happens when clouds cry, and I'm crying too.
I remember the studio was full of musicians and singers, and everybody was right on their toes. Bob had full control of everything, and he was just a genius. I will remember him as being a very fine gentleman and extremely talented, and I was very blessed to have met him and have him work with me, and I will never forget him.
Back in 1977, I had the pleasure of attending a Frankie Valli recording session in New York City, courtesy of record producer Charlie Colello. Not only did I get to meet Frankie and Charlie, I also got to meet the two gentlemen who wrote this song that Frankie recorded that day. It became part of his album called Lady Put the Light Out. That song, Native New Yorker, eventually became a big hit for New York City disco trio Odyssey. And the songwriters were Denny Randell and Sandy Linzer. And right now, it's my pleasure to say, hello, Denny.
Thank you so much, and it's so good to participate in this wonderful show you're doing about just an absolute incredible, talented, and wonderful person, Bob Crewe. I met Bob at the Randall session when the Four Seasons were recording Randall. That's the very first time Bob and I met. The Four Seasons and Bob were looking for a new arranger, and one person, Al Kasha, that was very close to them, also a top writer, an Academy Award writer himself, and great producer, was familiar with my work as a arranger, writer, and producer with the company I was working with. And when he knew that they were looking for a new arranger, he asked me if I would be interested. Of course, I certainly was, and I was always a big fan of the Seasons and Bob. Bob Gaudio and I got together. We hit it off personally and, of course, musically. And then immediately we went to meet Bob Crewe, and they just happened to be recording Ragdoll at that time. And that's when I met Bob and saw him at work as the amazing producer that he is.
So you came in actually as an arranger at that point.
Yes. In fact, I was arranging for the Four Seasons, which is the way, as I said, we met, before I actually started writing for them.
Did you arrange any of their charted hit records?
Yes, I did. And by the way, speaking of Ragdoll, I did go on to arrange much of the Ragdoll album. But as far as singles, I arranged Save It For Me, Big Man in Town. Several years later, I arranged And That Reminds Me for them.
Right.
And by the way, the very first thing I arranged, which is on the flip side of Let's Hang On, was a special theme song that Bob Crewe and Bob Gaudio wrote for the hit show at that time called On Broadway Tonight, which was a 16-piece band arrangement. It's probably the only record like that they have for the theme, and I arranged that for them as well.
We're now going to focus on three specific songs that you wrote. Two of these were co-writes with Sandy Linzer. Was he already working for Bob at that time?
Well, I know that they knew each other because he had previously done some things with the Seasons. But as far as he and I meeting, again, we met through Al Kasha. In fact, at the very same time that Al introduced me to Bob Gaudio, he said to me, you know, there's a writer out there. I just have a feeling that if you guys met and got together, there'd be a good chemistry. And he was right.
Sandy sent me an email telling me that he would not be able to participate via phone in this presentation, but he wanted me to read this comment. Bob Crewe was a very charismatic, brilliant guy. I learned a lot from him. We had three wonderful, fun-filled years working together, and he has a very special place in my heart. Denny, you and he were quite a team.
There was a period of a few years there where Sandy and I got really hot together and wrote both with Bob and the two of us, and then again for several years in the 70s. But also in the 70s, Bob and I also were writing just the two of us. Let's Hang On by the Four Seasons. That was written by Bob and I and Sandy.
That little chip of diamond on your hand, been a fortune, baby, but you know it stands for the love.
Don't you go, baby. Don't you go, baby. Let's stay in
That was the three of us. And later on, when Bob and I wrote Swearing to God, that was just Bob and I. That was in the 70s.
And that was a Frankie Valli solo hit.
Swearing to God, there's no one else on earth I'd rather be. Swearing to God, you made me see so I believe in thee. Oh, you've been filling my cup till I'm running over with joy from your heaven sent love. Just touch me again, I'm king of all men and reigning.
The other song I want to mention is one that you and Sandy wrote. It was based on Bach's Minuet in G, or Minuet in G Major, and that's A Lover's Concerto, a huge hit by the Toys. And we're going to sample that one elsewhere. As someone who worked with Bob Crewe quite a bit, what will you most remember about him?
Bob Crewe was an incredibly talented person, just in every way you could possibly think of, so positive, so soulful, and so spiritual in terms of the way he expressed himself, the way he wrote, the way he connected with others, and it just made working with him a special thing. He was a fabulous person, both as a creative person and as a spirit. He was great.
Next on our very special tribute to Bob Crewe, I have a rag doll.
Okay.
How's that? How do you like that? That was just improvised.
Sounds good to me.
Well, okay. Nothing wrong with being a rag doll if you happen to be Jean Thomas.
That's funny, yes.
Jean, thank you so much for joining me, and you are more than just a rag doll. You've done backups for so many different recordings. I have always felt that backup singers are really the unsung heroes of pop music.
Well, you know, the backup parts, whether they were made up on the spot or by an arranger, yes, I think they add so much.
How did you meet Bob Crewe?
Well, I had been in New York for a couple of years as a recording artist and was lucky enough after I started living in New York to start being hired by various songwriters to do demos of their material, and one of the songwriters was Denny Rendell. I had known Denny for quite a while and had sung on quite a few of his demos, and after the Four Seasons had a very successful hit with Ragdoll, he and Bob, I think it was Bob's idea of putting together a girls group called the Ragdolls, which would be a counterpart to the Four Seasons. And he thought I would be a good choice as the lead singer. So he had me come in and do a few of the songs, and Bob liked it. And there I was coming into the studio. Our first recording was Society Girl.
And that was a song co-written by Denny Rendell, Sandy Linzer, and Bob Crewe.
There were three women that I knew there who did the backup, and I put on the lead. And then this was done often, by the way, where there were really no groups. They were put together, and if it was successful, then a group was created.
So this was actually a studio group called...
The Ragdoll!
The three girls who were part of the studio group, Annie, Manny, and Franny.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes, it is. It was Ann Phillips, Marilyn Jackson, and Fran Carroll.
That was produced by Bob Crewe. And it was a hit, and so was the follow-up, also produced by Bob. Another song co-written by Denny Randell, Sandy Linzer, and Bob, called Dusty.
Dusty was the second record,
yes,
and actually hit higher on the chart.
And as Society Girl was inspired by the Four Seasons Ragdoll, Dusty was inspired by the Four Seasons Dawn Go Away.
Yes. My time with Bob was, I guess, about a year and a half, 2 years, something like that. He was a lovely man, always treated me with kindness and care and listened to my wants, and I found him a real gentleman. He was a very kind, good man and very talented.
I have on the phone right now a three-hit wonder. You know his hits. Seven little girls sitting in the back seat. That's right. And you can sing along with me. That's okay. And the next one, Let the Midnight Special. Sing a little bit louder.
Shine a light on me. Right.
Yes. And then my favorite.
happy-go-lucky me.
Mr. Paul Evans.
Hey, Ronnie, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Paul. Now, how about this one?
Roses are red, my love. Violets are blue. Sugar is sweet, my love, but not as sweet as you.
You wrote the music to that, a Bobby Vinton number one hit, and in fact, his first hit.
I did, and I got to tell you, a lot of these old songs, I mean, I live in Manhattan, a very expensive borough of a very expensive city, and I live here thanks to Roses Are Red and my copyrights.
You mean that one and the ones in addition to that?
Right. I just had two of my old copyrights come back at me as commercials when the Kalin Twins record that I wrote in, and it was a hit in 1958.
When you smile at me, well, I know our love will always be.
I just made some decent money on it because it was recorded and used in the UK by a big furniture chain there. And Happy-Go-Lucky Me, although it wasn't my version, it was a vaudevillian who cut it and actually beat me off the charts in England. And that's been used for The Clash of the Clans, which is a very large game app.
Yeah.
So two songs of mine from 1958 and 1960 have earned me some decent money this year. It is amazing.
As a songwriter and as a recording artist, I know you have great memories of Bob Crewe.
Sure.
Even though you didn't do any direct work for Bob Crewe, you had some thoughts that you wanted to express.
I can just say this, that he was known in the business as a monster. Now, that sounds awful, but it's not meant to be awful. It really, yes, and the word after monster is talent. And when we spoke to, oh, my God, that guy's a monster, we always meant the guy was a monster talent. That was Bob Crewe. We all knew what kind of talent he had. There was always a certain respect accorded to these people that we would call monsters. We knew who they were, and we knew what kind of talent for pop music they had. Some guys just had their fingers, or whatever you call it, on the pulse. They knew what was going on. They knew how to deliver a hit record. Bob Crewe was certainly at the top of that list.
When you were so
now we have an arranger, a record producer, a conductor, and singer Now, would you all please step up to the microphone? Wait a minute, there's only one person stepping up to the microphone, but he's all of them, and his name is Charlie Colello. What an honor it is to have you participate in this tribute to Bob Crewe.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to pay my respects to him.
We could focus on so many different aspects of your career because you worked with people including, this is like a who's who, Barbara Streisand, Frank Sinatra, Neil Diamond, Al Cooper, Bruce Springsteen, Laura Nero, Engelbert Humperdinck, Ray Charles, and Bobby Vinton, and Janice Eden, and Juice Newton, and a few others. When did you become inspired to be an arranger?
When I was a kid, when I first played music, my father wanted me to play accordion. So I learned accordion, and from playing accordion, I learned harmony. And I started to listen to the radio and play the songs on the radio and tried to figure out what the harmonies were. Also, I liked Frank Sinatra records, so at the age of 15, I started to take the orchestrations of the Frank Sinatra records off the record and write them down. I would listen to a song and write the first trumpet part out, then try to listen for the first sax part, then the first trombone part, then the strings. And then there was a group in my neighborhood which was very popular, and their accordion player was going to Harvard, and he was not going to be around, so they asked me if I would join the band. The first night I went to a rehearsal with them, they said they wanted to do a new arrangement on a song, so they said, Charlie, give us the notes from the chords. So I started to give them the notes. I played little things for them to play. They played the parts, and I heard them, and it inspired me to want to do that more often. And that's basically how I started writing arrangements.
It was Frankie Valli who first brought you to Bob Crewe's apartment in 1959. And very shortly thereafter, you were working for Bob as an arranger and conductor. Remember what the first released record was?
The first record I did was the Kevin McQuinn record, Every Step of the Way.
Hold it, come her hand so gently, Kevin.
And then we also did An Angel Cried, which is in Jersey Boys.
Hal Miller and the Rays, backed by members of what eventually would be the Four Seasons.
And raindrops fell down from the sky.
And then several of the other songs that were in Jersey Boys were also part of the records that I made with Bob Crewe during those early days.
To me, arrangers are among the unsung heroes of recordings. Most of the time, you can't just throw a lot of musicians in there and just say, okay, let's just wing the thing.
The public should only know what role the arrangers actually played in many of these hit records.
Bob told me when I interviewed him back in 2008, Bob Crewe was not really an arranger. But he said he occasionally would go over to the sheet music, which the arrangers would have, and he'd write little symbols. He would draw lightning to indicate that that portion of the music should be louder.
I'll give you a little background about how I worked with Bob and how Bob became my mentor. And this is what all of us learned, all of the Four Seasons, myself included, and everybody that worked with him closely. First of all, Bob was a master at making records commercial. So Bob would take an idea, he'd play it for us, and say the rhythm should do this. And if the rhythm was dun, 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 he would indicate that, and he'd say, that's what I want the rhythm to be. Then he would say, I'd like the guitars to play this. And he would basically sing me little things, and what I would do is I would take what he would sing, and I would start to write these on paper, because Bob couldn't write them out.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd say, make all this work, Charles. And then what I would do is study the rhythms, and I basically learned how to write for the bass, the drums, the guitars, the piano for pop records as a result of him giving me the direction. Later on, I was able to take the education I had and apply it to many, many other records. That was what Bob did. Now, when it came time to writing for the horns and writing for the strings, Bob would say, over here, I want this to sound like blue skies. And then I would have to get a visual picture of what he meant so that I could get the strings to do that. Or if he wanted the horns He'd say, I want nasty horns. And he would use expressions. Then he would play me definitions of what he liked. Did that for all of us. So we basically learned how to make records from Bob Crewe.
You're also a producer as well.
There's a difference between a Bob Crewe producer and a producer like me or Gaudio or like some of the other people that have produced records. What made Crewe unique, I'll give you a little bit of background as to my view of a producer. What a producer is supposed to do is he's supposed to find the artist, find the song, and make the record. Now, most producers, the record company gives them the artist. The artist may write the song, but Bob Crewe had to be all things. So Bob Crewe was a producer extraordinaire because he not only found the talent, but he made careers. He made the Four Seasons. He made Freddie Cannon. He made the Rays, Billy and Lily, Mitch Ryder, and the Detroit Wheels. And you go on and on with the artists that he developed that he gave careers to. As a producer, I was hired by record companies or by publishers that had the songs. They gave me the artist, and they asked me to make the record. So to me, making the record was not anything other than what I did as an arranger. But in truth, with all the hit records I had, and I had 38 top 10 hit records, and a lot of those records that I produced, most of them were produced via the artist and the record company bringing me the package. But Crewe was a lot different because he actually developed the talent.
Here's some of the hit Four Seasons records that you arranged. Became one of the Four Seasons.
Right after we made Let's Hang On, back up, I was one of the Four Lovers in 1958. So I knew most of the repertoire. The only thing I had not performed with them were the hit records, but since I made most of the hit records up to that point, when Nicky decided to leave, Tommy called me, and Tommy told me that I had to come and fill in for Nicky because Nicky was quitting the band. So he sent a limousine to pick me up, and I went out to Allentown, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And from Allentown, we drove to Ohio. And the first job that I played with them was at a racetrack for 10,000 people, and I rehearsed in the car.
And you not only arranged this recording, but you also sang on it as a member of the Four Seasons.
Yeah, I'm working my way back to you.
If it wasn't for Bob Crewe, I don't think I would have ever had a career. It was Frankie Valli who brought me into Bob Crewe, but it was Bob Crewe who actually taught me how to make records. Everything that I needed to know and was able to apply to records, and I thought that at that point I'd actually gotten to where I could be on my own. And Bob probably did not know really how talented he was. He was off the charts talented, more talented than probably any other producer I've ever worked with.
Now we have a Grammy-winning recording artist, and her name is... Well, before I tell you what her name is, I'm going to play a little bit of her Grammy-winning record.
When a deep purple falls over sleepy garden walls, and a star begins to twinkle in the night, in the midst of the memory, you wander on back to me, breathing my name with a sigh.
Well, that wasn't all her on the record. Some guy was on the record. We'll have to ask her who the guy was. Ladies and gentlemen, April Stevens. How are you?
Hi, Ronnie. And hi, everybody. The guy with me was my brother, Nino Tempo.
Okay. Nino Tempo and
yeah.
April Stevens, the Grammy-winning act. What was the category that you won for?
Surprisingly, it was a rock and roll.
Best rock and roll recording.
Yeah, I know.
Did you consider Deep Purple a rock and roll record when you recorded it?
No, we didn't. But we were in the rock and roll business, and I don't think we ever really thought about what kind of a record it was. They had it up there in the rock and roll era.
Deep Purple, by the way, was a number one hit. Now, I know you never worked directly with Bob Crew, but doing the recordings that you did, some of them with your brother Nino, and a few that you did on your own in the early 50s, you got to understand the importance of everybody who is connected with a recording, the producers.
I heard that name constantly. Bob Crew was just wonderful, and I think at one time we even called and tried to get him to record us, but he was in New York most of the time, and we were in Los Angeles. But he was just the best, and we were very disappointed that he couldn't fit us in at that particular time that we were available. But it was a busy period. He was the best. I'm very saddened by his departure.
And now on our very special tribute to Bob Crew, I am pleased to present a wonderful, very well-respected producer, arranger, and songwriter. His name is Herb Bernstein. Are you any relation to either Leonard Bernstein or Sid Bernstein?
No, neither. I knew Sid very well, and Leonard I met several times, but I can't say we are related. I'd love to, but we're not.
Okay. Where and when did you first meet Bob Crew?
Gosh, it goes way back. Bob was quite successful, and I was really just trying to break into the business. I had a few things recorded, and I was doing a lot of arranging, but I can't say I really hit it big to any extent. And a couple of young fellows came to my office one day. I had an office over at the Ed Sullivan building there, and they came in, they wanted me to do some arrangements, and their names were Bud Rehak and Eddie Rambo. It turns out they were working for Bob Crew, and I did a couple of arrangements for them, and we all hit it off, and I ended up going up to their office to visit them and go over some of the music, and I met Dan Crew. And Dan and I hit it off terrifically. Dan was just such a sweet guy. And he said, I want to get you in here to work for Bob. At the time, the arranger he was using mostly was Charlie Colello.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie, you know, was terrific. He had a lot of hits. And I couldn't seem to break in there, you know, because Charlie was doing so well. But there came a point where Charlie got hired at Columbia, CBS, whatever it was called at that time, and he couldn't do outside work. He couldn't continue working for Bob, and then Bob started to use me. And we really hit it off, and we wrote some songs together, and we'd spent a lot of time together, and I started doing most of his arrangements, and that was pretty much how it started.
There's one record which, in the mid-60s, I believe you both produced and arranged, and it was for an unknown singer who was unknown before the record came out, her name, Norma Tanaga.
I love Norma. She was great. And it's a funny story that no one even knows. I was at this time working for Bob, and I used to teach in high school in Brooklyn. And this girl, one of my students, came up to the office one day. She said she was in the neighborhood, and then she called me and all that. And she kept bugging me about this friend of hers who was a great guitarist and a songwriter. And I said, yeah, well, I kept kind of pushing her off. And she kept bugging me and bugging me. Finally, I said, I'll bring her up. So she brought her up. It was Norma Tanaga. And she was a wonderful classical guitar player. She started playing and singing some of these tunes. And I just thought Walking My Cat Named Dog was such a commercial. Yeah, it just had something to it that I thought could make some noise. So we went in the studio and we did the recording. I produced it and arranged it. Bob heard it, he loved it, and put it out, and it was a big hit.
Me and my cat named Dog.
Remember most about Bob is his brilliance. Whatever he did, I don't know if you're aware of it, he was a marvelous painter. He made some magnificent painting. It was great. Whatever he did, he wrote poetry. He was an innovator, and I learned so much from him, and I really credit Bob with anything I am today or was or will be is really so much had to do with him.
Let's play Name That Tune. Well, if you said that was Minuet in G or Minuet in G major, you can go to the head of the class. The tune is attributed to the great German composer Johann Sebastian Bach. In the mid-1960s, songwriters Denny Randell and Sandy Linzer adapted that tune to create a wonderful pop song called A Lover's Concerto. And if you said it was that, well, you can also go to the head of the class. And if you can tell me who the next guest on this show is, I'm going to throw in a few gold stars as well. Did you say Barbara Harris, the lead singer of the Toys, who recorded that song? You're absolutely right. Welcome, Barbara. And thank you for joining us on
My pleasure,
this
Ron.
Tribute to Bob Crewe. How and when did you first meet him?
We were doing a talent show. We were in high school, and we had a fellow who came to hear us from our manager. This guy became our manager afterwards. But this guy that came to hear us, he was working for Vince Mark, which became our manager, and Bob Crewe. You know, they were all connected. And he came and saw us, and he says, listen, I want to take you up to meet some people. And he took us to meet our manager first, and our manager, which was Vince Mark, he introduced us to Bob Crewe, and oh my God, we fell in love with him. All of us liked him right away. When we put out the first album, he took us to get the pictures taken. I believe he was the one that set up the whole thing on the picture.
Right.
It was a box. I think you've seen it on the album
cover. On the album cover, yes.
Yeah, that was his idea.
Oh.
And it worked out really well, you know. We looked at it kind of funny when we first saw it.
Interesting.
And he had taken us to get some outfits, and we actually liked those outfits.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man.
Some of the other ones we bought, we didn't care for too much.
So this is on the album, The Toys?
Yes. Was it? I think Lover's Concerto and Attack.
Now, wait a minute. Who's the dog?
Yeah, I got a...
No, that's okay. That's okay. But I want to know who the dog is, because when I do interviews, I always have dogs in the background. So what is the dog's name?
Okay. Her name is Jenny Ray, and she's a golden cocker spaniel.
Oh.
Pretty dog.
Okay. Everybody is going to know who she is. Okay.
She's my mother-in-law's dog. I'm just babysitting.
Okay.
For her. But I do have a dog too, and he's a big brute.
Oh, he is. But I assume we're not going to hear him today.
No, I'm keeping him out. His bark is too loud.
He's
going to
be jealous, though, when
yes, he will.
You know, the other dog gets on and he doesn't get on. Anyway, Bob Crewe helped you pick your outfits out.
Yes.
So Bob was not just a record producer, but he also was a fashion coordinator.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes. He was,
another side
was
of Bob.
Amazing. Another, yeah, he was amazing.
Well, who actually produced the Lover's Concerto?
The producers, I think, was him. He was involved, but Sandy and Denny and Charlie Colello is
right.
The ones I remember.
Well, Charlie Colello did the arrangement on it, right?
Yes, he did.
And it came out on Dyna Voice.
His label.
What was your reaction when the song was first presented to you?
We were together, you know, the girls, Barbara Toomer and June Montero and myself. Oh, my God, we were jumping up and down.
Barbara, what will you remember most about Bob Crewe?
He took three young ladies from out of high school, and, you know, we didn't know what we were going to do. We knew we wanted to sing, and he gave us a chance. He put us on his label, you know. He actually gave us a chance to get out there and show our talent, you know, make a little money. We didn't make that much money, but it was an opportunity, you know, to travel. We traveled all over the world. And he was the cause of it. I'll never, ever forget him for that.
Next, we have a man who, back in 1965, was indeed a big wheel around the Bob Crewe organization. Is that true, Gary Knight of Day and Night?
Yes, it is.
Now, what do I mean by you being a big wheel?
Well, I was asked to join a group in the studio called Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. So I became a round figure around there.
Wow.
They needed a keyboard player. I played honky-tonk piano, regular piano, Hammond B3 organ. Anything that had to do with keyboards is what I did, and that's what I was hired to do. And I became their regular keyboard player on all of the Mitch Ryder Detroit Wheels records.
Was it Bob Crewe that hired you to do that?
He did. It was all his idea.
Now, the Day and Night thing came before that, right?
A little bit before it, yes. I believe it was about, you said, around 65 when we actually got together.
Okay, so you're invited to join this group. And how many people were in the Detroit Wheels in addition to Mitch Ryder?
I believe there was four. A rhythm guitar, lead guitar, bass, and drum.
Initially, there were four, and you were hired last?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I was hired to join a group that was already in existence. I was an addition.
Okay, well, it's always better to be an addition than a subtraction, as I say.
That's for sure.
So now we have the Detroit Wheels. Tell me a little bit about Mitch. What was your experience first meeting Mitch?
He worked hard. Anytime he ever got on mic, he gave it his all, 100%. And he was a heck of a good artist. He really was. I felt as a singer, he was perfect with the group. And at that time, those records are inimitable. They're going to probably be around for another 30, 40 years, as they have been so far.
Bob Crewe told me that Mitch Ryder was one-take Ryder. You didn't do a lot of extra takes. Generally, you would get it the first time, right?
That's right.
Now, we say keyboard. Was it an electric piano, or what kind of a piano was it that you played on these hit records?
Acoustic piano, regular piano. I played the honky-tonk piano, and I played the Hammond B3 organ.
Okay.
And those were keys to those arrangements. If you listen closely to those records, whether it be the organ or the piano, those were integral parts. Those records, if you remember, made you get up and dance. You couldn't just sit there and listen.
And this one was the biggest of those records. Devil with a Blue Dress On and Good Golly Miss Molly.
Devil with a blue dress on. See the devil.
Gary, I know there are some thoughts that you would like to express about Bob Crewe.
Let me just say that his company name was Genius Incorporated, and believe me, that was not an ego. That was the truth.
Right.
This guy had talent in so many different areas. People don't realize he had painting shows the last 20 years. His paintings were famous. He was an interior decorator for his apartment, which became the centerfold of Life magazine. There's so many things that Bob did. He had a library of music that you wouldn't believe. He was a student of classical music. He couldn't play an instrument, but yet he could hear a string line. He could tell the guitar player what to do. He had no musical background other than the fact that he studied music in the past, and he just had a natural ability like no one else I ever met.
Right now, it is my pleasure to present a member of the Four Seasons. He waited a long time to become a member of the Four Seasons. Pun intended. His name is Joe Long. And Joe, welcome to this very special presentation.
Oh, thank you, Ronnie. It's really a pleasure to be here with you.
Where and when do you recall first meeting Bob Crewe?
Well, it would have been the first session that I was on after I joined the Four Seasons.
Oh,
that would have been the Opus 7.
Oh, okay, Opus 17. I was wondering if you were doing something in the background prior to that with Bob.
No, I never met Bob until that first session.
Obviously, since you were not on the early Four Seasons hits like Sherry, Big Girls Don't Cry, Walk Like a Man, Don't Go Away, and Ragdoll, having not been on those sessions, were you a fan of the group?
Yeah, I would say anybody involved in music or listening to music back in the 60s had to be a fan of the Four Seasons. And let's face it, the group was just so instrumental in bringing such a great, unique sound to the music industry, and you could tell from note one that it was Frankie and the Boys.
Where were you living during the early 60s?
I was living at that time in Elizabeth, New Jersey, maybe about 20 minutes west of New York on the other side of the river.
You never had any dreams that you were going to eventually become a member of this group?
No, that came right out of left field. An agent that was booking the group that I had at that time also happened to be booking the Four Seasons on some of the local gigs, some of the universities
right.
in Jersey. I was working with Al and Jet Lauren Review, husband and wife team out of New Jersey. We played Vegas a lot. It was primarily a Vegas-type group. And when Nick Massey left, this agent went to approach Tommy and said, well, I think there's a guy in one of the bands that I book that would be a natural replacement. So he introduced me to Tommy. Then Tommy introduced me to the other guy. So, no, I had no idea that anything like that was coming.
Are you a bass singer? In other words, was your role in the group as a
well,
bass singer?
Not legitimately. I'm more of a baritone. But, you know, Nicky had that kind of husky voice. And my voice, as you can hear, is also very husky and very raspy at times. So I was able to simulate that sort of quasi-bass sound that Nicky used.
Once you joined the group, you performed a lot of shows with them, right? In addition to being in the recording studio.
Yeah.
Were you doing Nicky's part, like in Sherry, for example, in Big Girls Don't Cry?
Yeah. When we did any of the original songs on stage, I duplicated Nick's parts. But shortly after I joined the group, we inverted the harmonies to take advantage of the fact that I could sing a little higher than Nicky. That left Tommy down at the bottom, and I kind of filled the gap between Tom and Bob Gordia. So the whole sound of the group got higher. And I guess a good example of that would be I've Got You Under My Skin, where the vocal sound is on a much higher plane harmonically than the original song.
But why should I try to resist when, darling, I know so well
there was one single that came out, which became a top 10 record, right after Nicky had left the group. Charlie Colello took over for that one record, Working My Way Back to You. That was the interim period between the Nicky era and the Joe era.
Yeah, well put.
Era. That's E-R-A, folks, not E-R-R-O-R. I want to make that clear.
Okay, well, either one applies.
In addition to Opus 17, Don't You Worry About Me, and I've Got You Under My Skin, here's a montage of a few more Four Seasons hit recordings that your voice was on.
Tell it to the rain and the stars that shine above. Let it be your thinking of, and I'm your love. Tell it to the rain.
Well, that last one was really by The Wonder Who, but close enough for rock and roll. Joe, I know you have some special thoughts about Bob Crewe.
You know, Ronnie, the term genius is thrown around these days indiscriminately. Everybody, he's a genius, she's a genius, but Bob Crewe was a bona fide genius. Bob Crewe could hear a demo. And back then, you know, demo tapes were not as they are today. You didn't have to bring a full production to a studio. Back then, demo tapes were a singer and a guitar or a singer and a piano. Bob could listen to that singer being backed up by that piano and in his mind can visualize a hit record. He'd construct it in his mind instantaneously. In a flash, he'd know what to do with that song. He was a hit maker, a wonderful, wonderful producer, but beyond that, he was a great guy.
Right now, I welcome an American producer whose music has been heard all around the world. He's produced somewhere around 36 gold and platinum recordings. Am I doing well so far?
Doing great.
About 54 recordings on the Billboard charts. And I'm just going to give you a few names of people that he has produced in no particular order. Gloria Gaynor, Engelbert Humperdinck, Andrew Dice Clay. Let's move on. Laura Branigan, The New Seekers, Helen Reddy, Tommy James and the Shondells, a classical music act called the Five Browns, and somebody named Joel Diamond. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Joel Diamond. You produced yourself?
I know, it's crazy. I was actually a recording artist of different record labels. I was on Atlantic, I was on Columbia, and...
How about Casablanca?
Neil Bogart signed me as an artist.
And there's this one album that I remember from a few years ago where on the front cover it's you riding a harmonica.
Yes, it is.
What was that album called? The Joel Diamond something.
The Joel Diamond Experience.
You also produced Screaming Jay Hawkins.
Oh, God, yeah. That was a long time ago.
Mike
great.
Douglas, Soupy Sales, Al Martino. We could do an hour just listing the acts that you've produced.
Well, the interesting part about it, Ronnie, is that they span the entire dimension of recording. I mean, I went from classical with the Five Browns. I produced 3 number one albums for them in a row.
Right.
And they became the first family of classical music. And as you said, all the way to the other end of the spectrum with Andrew Dice Clay.
Yes. If we were doing samples of that album, we could only hear about maybe 10 seconds on the air. One of your most famous productions was this one by Engelbert Humperdinck. A producer yourself, I have a good idea of how much you appreciate Bob Crewe.
Well, I met Bob Crewe many, many, many years ago in New York when he had his own label, and of course he was producing Oliver, and he was something so special. I knew Bob, and Bob knew me, because at that time I was running CBS Music, and also Mercury Records Music. I was producing one of Engelbert Humperdinck's albums, and I was trying to collect a wonderful group of songwriters, and I was able to contact Bob at the time, and Bob wrote a song just specifically for that album for Engelbert. It was called After You.
After you, nothing new. Anyone I meet seems so incomplete after you.
You don't always remember a person's name, but you always remember how they made you feel. And Bob was one of those kind of people, he made everybody feel important. And that's what I loved about him.
That concludes part two of our tribute. Please stay tuned for part three.